Okay, last time we had entered into, we had done chapter 13, entered into the first part of chapter 14, and we're talking about Judas going to the chief priests and the elders, and they promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to betray Jesus. Thank you, I got some in my pocket. I don't want to take yours just in case you need it. But thank you, Bobby, I do have some in my pocket. Of course, the thing is, you put them in there and you walk around for a while and then you go to pull them out and you can't get the wrapper off. It sticks to them. We're talking about halls. Talking about halls. Cough drops. You walk around with them in your pocket and then you go to open them up and it's paper sticks to them. So you have to throw them away or just take those and eat the paper with them. So. Then Judas Iscariot, in verse 10, Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to betray him. Judas' betrayal agreement is really interesting. You know, we in Gospel of John says he was a treasure and had stolen from the money before and all that kind of stuff. That's John's perspective. Matthew says that he went and asked for money. Here in Mark, which is the older of the Gospels, he agrees to hand over Jesus, but he's not promised the money until after he agrees to hand him over. So, you know, over the millennia, people have talked about why did he do it, that kind of thing. And of course, the most common answer is he did it for the money. But as we've said before, 30 pieces of silver was the price of a common slave on the auction block. Had he wanted more, he could have asked it and gotten it. 30 pieces of silver was also, if Al agreed to turn Ed over to the authorities for something, and they'd say, okay, well, we need to know where he's going to be, what time to show up. And Al said, well, show up at this time in that place. This is back then. They would offer him good faith money. If he took it, then they figured they could trust him and Ed would be there. It's only going to be 30 pieces of silver. And there was a novel, I, Judas, by Taylor Caldwell, which takes a similar tack as well. And the Gospel of Judas claims that kind of thing too, although it's a non-canonical book and doesn't really show up till a couple of centuries later. But if he agrees to take the good faith money, then they know they can trust him. If he doesn't, then they're going to arrest him for trying to defraud them. Well, the good faith money typically at that time was 30 pieces of silver. So, Mark says that, you know, Judas went to betray him, and the word betray means to hand over. We think, you know, we read all kinds of other things in it, but the word in the Greek here, all it means is to hand him over for whatever reason. And so, you know, we've got the handoff here that's going to take place, and they promised to give him money, and he sought an opportunity to hand him over or to betray him.
Why did they need him? I never have understood. I mean, everybody knew what Jesus looked like and everything else.
Well, but... Why? That's a good question there, but see, Jesus has been in and out. He comes in and he's surrounded by crowds, and then about the time the crowds start going home to eat, he takes off and goes back to Bethany. And then turns around and comes back. Robert?
Well, why should we put more faith in one of these than the other?
You got different ideas. Money is the most common one. Some people have said because in the Gospel of Luke at the Last Supper, the text says after they finished the Last Supper, he says, then the devil entered into him and he went and got the officials and betrayed him. So this another idea is that Luke puts out there is that this demonic spirit takes him over, and causes him to do it. There are others who say, just like you're mentioning here, Jim, it was God's predestined plan. God predetermined it. God was the one that chose Judas to do it. What's really interesting is that if you've ever seen the rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar, that's the tack that they take in that Judas had no choice. God predestined it. Judas had no choice. In fact, as he's going out to hang himself in that, their perspective is, you know, he's running along saying, God, why did you choose me for your crime? There's a fourth major understanding. Whatever, he does it. He hands him over. But Ed, in answer to your question, he's back and forth, so they needed somebody on the inside to say, okay, you can find him here at this time. The fourth is, you know, as we said before, Judas Iscariot is the Greek for Judah, or Jude-ish man from Kerioth, which was a hotbed for zealots. It was a town, if you were a zealot, you couldn't find anybody that agreed with you, you could go there and you had plenty of people. The majority of the population were in agreement with the zealots who were looking for that earthly political kingdom, that earthly political Messiah that they'd been thinking of to come and kick out the Romans, set up the kingdom of David, sit on David's throne again, from Isaiah chapter 9, sit on the throne of David and rule and reign. And they would be a part of that. And the zealots really wanted it. I mean, the zealots actually had tried to get Judas Maccabeus, get people to think he was Messiah back at the Maccabean revolt. And he gets assassinated through a plot perpetrated by one of his younger brothers and somebody else. And then that brother takes over, and then he gets assassinated through a plot by one of his brothers and some other guys. And then he takes over, and a couple of years later, he gets assassinated by one of his brothers. So, yeah, kind of a tough thing. Well, you know, brothers do fight. And so, there are folks who think he was a zealot who thought Jesus was that Messiah. And when Jesus starts talking about, my kingdom's not in this world, well, wait a minute, you're supposed to rule in this world if you're a Messiah. My kingdom's in the other world. No, you're supposed to rule here. I'm going to suffer and be persecuted and die. What's going to happen to us? Thomas had already asked that earlier when they went in the Gospel of John, said, well, we might as well go and die with him. That Judas got disillusioned and said, well, by golly, I'll force you. I'll force your hand. You'll either die or you'll have to stand up and prove that you're Messiah. And then Judas would be his right-hand man because he had helped him do that. Whatever the case, Judas hands him over. Yes, Robert.
That's good on telling you.
Whichever one you feel led to.
In all of them, but it's still, you know, it's still just what somebody's been told.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's got, okay.
Yeah. And it's just, well, I mean, even in the Gospels, you got John says he stole from the treasury. So he was looking to make money. Well, if he's looking to make money, why settle for 30 pieces of silver when these rich guys could pay whatever he asked? Matthew says he did it for the money, but 30 pieces of silver. And what does he do in Matthew after he finds out Jesus is sentenced to die? Brings it back, tries to buy him back, and then can't live with himself. And Luke says, well, the devil made him do it. Flip Wilson. Yeah. Whatever the case is, Judas was in a position on the inside to do this, and Jesus knew Judas was the one that was most likely to do it. Because he gets to that point in the Last Supper and reveals who it is that one of them is doing this. And, of course, in one of the Gospels, Judas says, you know, is it I? And Jesus says, go and do what you have to do quickly. So, you know, that's, in any case, Jesus was aware, and Judas, which sometimes makes, it really makes me think it's much more likely that Judas was a zealot, and Jesus knew that, and knew the aspirations Judas had. Now, Simon the Zealot evidently changed his ways. He didn't try to push Jesus into that. But the fact that Jesus seems to have known that Judas was the one most likely makes me think, since Judas was from Kerioth, he probably was. And he may have, you know, we're not told, but Judas may have tried to talk Jesus into, you know, come on, stand up, you know, do this kind of stuff.
That'd be a good argument for predestination.
Well, unless it's his choice to be the zealot. Yeah. Oh, I mean, he does. He says, you know, he says, the Son of Man, woe unto the one who's dipping bread. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. Well, is that because he does the betrayal? Is that because he had no choice in the betrayal? Or is that because the way people are going to see him from that point on? In fact, the name Jude and Judah, or Judas in Greek, really popular name among Jews, but it sure fell out of favor among early Christians. They stopped naming people that. And in fact, in the Gospels, well, there are two Judases. But there's Judas Iscariot, But then there, and when you look at the list, it says, and Judas, also known as Thaddeus. But then if you see his name anywhere else, it's Thaddeus. It's not Judas. Because of what that had done, what was associated with that. And so, you know, the real question is, the Son of Man goes, it is written, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. Verse 21, it would have been better for that man if he had not been born. People have been arguing for centuries over, does that mean Judas was condemned and he's burning somewhere? Or does that mean it's better that he had not been born because he participated in that? Now everybody's hung that around his neck. Only God knows for sure. But I get those questions. And when you've got different stories in the different Gospels, from their perspectives, you get those questions. So, that and a dollar gets you drink a drink machine, unless they're more expensive or less expensive. You know, and people can agree or not, but I tend to think he was a zealot. And he either got disillusioned and upset. You mean I followed you for 3 years and now you're going to wimp out? Well, by golly, I'll put you over here and you either prove that you're the Messiah or you're going to die. But I don't think when Judas went to hand him over, given the fact that he brought the money back and he said, I've betrayed innocent blood. And they said, so what? You live with it. We got what we want. And he throws the money down. He doesn't even go to the bar to drown his sorrows. He throws the money down and then goes and kills himself. I think he never intended for Jesus to die. And when he realized how horrendous it was, he couldn't live with himself. Peter, on the other hand, turns around and betrays. But Peter does. I mean, he betrays in his own way when he denies. I mean, the denial is a betrayal. But he came back. Right. Yes, he was. He was expecting Jesus to do something to stop that. Yeah. And I know we never these days expect Jesus to do something, right? And then get disappointed if it doesn't turn out the same way we want it. So he looks for a chance to hand him over. And he doesn't get the money until after the fact. This isn't, we're going to pay you ahead of time, go stick it in the bank kind of thing. Then we have, on the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb, his disciples said to him, where will you have us go and prepare for you to eat the Passover? Now, this is where Mark disagrees with John, and where the synoptic gospel writers, Matthew and Luke, also disagree with John. Remember, John, in our study before the Gospel of John, Jesus is crucified at the same time the Passover lamb. So the meal is the night before, and it's not a Passover meal. Here, Mark says, the first day of unleavened bread, when they sacrificed the Passover lamb. So this is truly a Passover meal that they're celebrating here. So this is the Thursday. John has Jesus crucified on this day. Mark, Matthew, and Luke say, no, he eats the Passover meal, and then on Friday mornings when he's crucified. But I understand that John's trying to give a theological interpretation of what God's doing. If Jesus is crucified at the time the Passover lambs are killed, then he is saying what God is doing in Jesus is getting rid of all of these other sacrifices. Jesus is a perfect sacrifice.
Maybe he was called to the part of sacrifice, put a crucifixion when he actually started, not for beating them with chains.
Well, no, John actually has him hung on a cross at the same time, at high noon, without Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
And so Jesus sends them out to the disciples because they say, where do you want us to eat this? He says, go into the city. A man carrying a jar of water will meet you and follow him. Now, why is that important? Why is that a signal? A man carrying a jar of water in the city.
Well, a lot of people could carry water in a jug in the city, but is he going to use... Well, I was going to say, was he going to turn the water into the wine that he used for the supper?
Yeah. No. But as I told somebody yesterday at one of those weddings, they were talking about the grape juice and all, and you know, they said, you know, we Baptists, we drink. I said, well, you know, Baptists are more powerful than Jesus. Jesus turned water to wine. We turn wine to Welch's. But a little known historical fact is that one of the movers and shakers in the temperance movement, which is when Baptists stopped using wine for communion, was married and her last name was Welch. But Betty, you're right. The women carried the water, not the men. The men didn't go drag out the water. The men were out doing other things. That was woman's work, was to get the jar of water. And so this man carrying a jug of water, go see him, because that's the unusual sign, the man carrying the jug of water, which has had many scholars to say that, you know, this was Jesus had already chosen the place. He had already spoken to the people where he wanted to have this Passover meal. And so that was the sign by which these disciples would know. And the code, you know, they go up and they're to say, the teacher says, where is my guest room where I'm to eat the Passover? And he will show you a large upper room. That's kind of like, you know, you don't go up to just any guy and say, hey, the teacher, the rabbi, Jesus, he wants, and then you're talking to somebody that's a Roman that turned you over. Yeah. So this is the code. The man's carrying, so we got dun, 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 Mission Impossible. Now we got the code here. The man's carrying the jug of water, which was women's work, in the middle of the day, or the middle of the afternoon. Early afternoon, because Passover lambs had just been slaughtered. Early afternoon. And women went to get the water typically early in the morning. And or late in the evening. That's why the Samaritan woman at the well was in the middle of the day at lunchtime, because she didn't want to have to deal with all these other people messing with her. And then the code is the teacher wants to know, and that person, come on with me then. So you got the sign and you got the secret code. And so they set out, went to the city, found it as he told them, and prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he came with the 12. Now, what would have happened here is they would have gathered for the Passover between the evenings once again. They would have gathered for the Passover they would have begun gathering for that meal when the sun touches the horizon. Remember, we've said before in the past that with the Passover meal in particular, in Exodus, when it says, you shall kill your lambs, and most of our translations say in the evening, literally in Hebrew, it's between the evenings. And there were two evenings. When the sun touched the horizon was the first evening. When the sun disappeared was the second evening. And so they, in that time period is when they gather here. They go into the city, all of them now, Jesus, et cetera, because he's not in the city at this particular point in time. He's outside the city. And they go in the evening between those times. And as they were at table eating, then Jesus tells them, one of you will betray me. And they start looking at each other. And then they look at Jesus, you know, they can't imagine betraying. Is it I? Is it I? And he said to him, is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. In one of the other gospels, he says that just as Judas is dipping the bread in the sop. Some people have said this is the same thing. One who is dipping bread with me, that can be either one of you that's dipping it, or Jesus at this time is dipping bread in the sop and Judas is dipping at the same time. So it's revealed that there's a betrayer. And as we said before, there was no double dipping. You didn't dip twice. I mean, and they knew that because of sharing germs, spreading germs. So for all you ladies, it would drive you crazy, because you dipped, you bit off the bread, and if you had it left over and you decided you didn't want to eat anymore, because it was dry and you wanted to dip, you threw it on the floor. No. The dogs would eat. And that's why the dogs are sitting there going, come on, come on, come on, come on. And that was most of the time. Now, in this particular instance, it says, for the Son of Man, once again, we've said that Jesus, in the Gospel of Mark, never refers to himself as Messiah. It's always as Son of Man, Son of Man. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born. He's talking about the prophets. Isaiah, who talked about he is wounded for our transgressions. That's what he's talking about. You know, the prophet has written about him. Now it's coming true.
Were they served by women?
At this particular point in time, there would have been women there that would have served. And if tradition says it's the house in which John Mark grew up, and his mother would have come in and placed the food, but then she would have backed out with all these men here. Now, we've said before, Da Vinci was wrong. His picture, they're not sitting around a table. Most of the time, they would sit around tables, but they weren't sitting around tables because the Passover meal was supposed to be eaten reclining. So they would either a low table like this or a mat on the floor, and they'd be lying on their left elbow and reach out this way. Because in Passover, they're supposed to eat it fully clothed with their staff with them and reclining. They would be lying like this, and a table would be here, and they would be reaching out like this because Pharaoh comes to them in the middle of the night, and they have to get out of bed and leave. And so everything that's done, all the foods and every action, is representative and symbolic of that meal. And so they would have been reclining, not sitting around a table like Da Vinci's painting. And so the only one that's reclining in that one is whoever's the beloved disciple that's leaning back towards Jesus in that particular painting.
We weren't allowed to make pictures in
that. They wouldn't let you get a little piece of paper and charcoal in that.
It took up
a
whole wall.
Oh, I know. Now, during the Passover meal, of course, there are places where everything, you know, the roasted egg, long before the Easter Bunny comes along, the roasted egg was a symbol of sacrifice and life and springtime. Later as it developed, you didn't have the whole lamb. Now, when Passover was first done, you had to eat the whole lamb during the night. But they'd have a leg of lamb, and everybody would eat some of the leg of lamb at a particular point in time. There would be greens. Typically, the greens were parsley, and they were dipped in salt water as part of the ceremony that went on. There'd be a point where something would be read or said, and you would dip them in salt water to remind you of the tears. The greens represent springtime and life. The salt water, the tears in Egypt. Of course, the bitter herbs. Horseradish was the prescribed bitter herb. If you didn't have it, you could use chicory or dandelion. That reminded you of the bitterness of slavery in Egypt. The haraset, which was a mixture of chopped apples and nuts mixed with cinnamon and wine, was mixed to a consistency like mortar. And so it reminded you of the mortar between the bricks in slavery. But then the matzah, which is the unleavened bread, and those horrible matzah crackers that you can buy in the store. But it was the unleavened bread, more like pita bread. But the unleavened bread was the bread of affliction that reminded you, A, heavy burdens in Egypt. That's why it's flat. B, you're not going to have time to put the yeast in, knead the dough, let it rise, and cook it, because you're going to be run out in the middle of the night. So everything that's eaten has a particular meaning, as well as what is said, and even the means of reclining, that would be done. So at a particular point in time, Jesus would be talking about the bread of affliction. And it's at that point that Jesus adds something to it. Now, Passover itself is a remembrance of the physical freedom from slavery. What Jesus does by talking about this bread is his body, he is adding, it's not just physical freedom, he's adding that it's spiritual freedom through his sacrifice that he is giving, and freedom for everlasting life. So at a particular point in time, as they're sharing that meal and as they're talking through the events of the Exodus, he would have broken this bread and passed it around to them. And as he does it, he blesses it and gives it to them and says, "Take, this is my body." Now, during the Passover meal, and this might also, not only is it late, but this might also explain why the disciples went to sleep. During the Passover meal, there are, as a part of it, you use 4 cups of wine. Each of them stands for one of the promises that God makes in Exodus 6, 6 and 7. And so at different points in that, there would be a cup of wine that would be blessed and then would be used, and one of these verses would be recited. So when Jesus takes the cup, it's one of these 4 cups of wine that would have been used. those promises are, say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. That's number one. I will deliver you from their bondage. That's the second promise and the second cup. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great acts of judgment. That's the third promise. And in verse 7 of Exodus 6, I will take you for my people and be your God. And so when Jesus is doing this, it's still tied to that Passover meal that they're celebrating, only he adds to it that spiritual dimension and that everlasting life dimension. And so here, he takes a cup. Don't know whether it was the first, second, third, or fourth. But he takes a cup, gives thanks, gave it to them, and they all drank from it. And he said to them, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many. Truly I say to you, I shall not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. Jesus here is speaking of his blood as part of the reality of the new relationship with God. His body and his blood. A new relationship with God here in what he is giving. Now, while we understand it differently, I do have to say to folks, and I tell folks regularly in classes and all when we talk about this, our Roman Catholic friends, as literal as some Baptists say they are about the Bible, this is one place they're not. Our Roman Catholic friends are about as literal as you can get, they and our Lutheran friends, because technically, in fact, the verb is not even in there. In the Greek it says, this bread, my body. This cup, my blood. So literally, bread equals body, cup equals blood. So when they say through the doctrine of transubstantiation that it actually changes to flesh and blood, even though it still looks like bread and wine and tastes like bread and wine, they're being very literal in their understanding, not recognizing that it's symbolic or representative. And these days they even add another phrase. They say they're taking in the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. So one of the things that sanctifies them is Jesus' divinity that's present in the bread and the wine. That's transubstantiation. Consubstantiation, some other churches hold to, and that is, it doesn't change, but alongside the bread and the wine is the flesh and the blood. And then you've got the symbolic and representational views that it doesn't literally change, it's still bread and wine, but it's symbolic of, or it represents, we participate vicariously with Jesus, our representative, like we're supposed to participate vicariously in government by our representatives. Notice I said supposed to. It is that literalness, by the way, in church history, that literal understanding that caused Nero and the Romans to really be suspicious of Christians, and Nero said, yeah, let's go ahead and kill them in horrible ways, because Tacitus writes in his annals that Christians were considered cannibals because they talked about eating the flesh and drinking the blood of one Crestus. And cannibalism, even in the Roman Empire, was considered forbidden. Melchizedek?
It
wasn't symbolic of that. Those were staples back then, especially if you were Melchizedek's king of Salem, priest of God Most High, you were expected, if you had guests come in, and especially important guests, to have food and drink for them. That's why in the parable when Jesus talks about the man has guests come in late at night and he doesn't have any food and he doesn't have any drink, he runs next door to his neighbor and bangs on the door, and a guy said, I'm already in bed. That kind of thing. It's because that was the expectation. Woe be unto you. It was considered something of a curse upon your, a plague upon your house if you didn't have it and you had visitors that showed up. So Melchizedek would have had that, and especially since A, he's a king, and B, He has such an, I mean, if you had a great invited guest or a great guest that showed up like Abraham, whose reputation had preceded him and all this kind of stuff, you weren't going to give him bread and water. Yeah. You weren't going to give him soda crackers and, you know, and Coke. You were going to give him what was good and what was expected. That is, you were going to bring out the wine and you were going to bring out the good bread. And probably with olive oil. Although I never saw what Bluto and Popeye saw in her, but no, probably with olive oil for the, to go on the bread and olive oil to anoint him. You know, that's the way. So forget all this oil of Olay and all this other stuff that's got all these chemicals and animal parts in it. Just go get you some olive oil and put it on your hair and on your face. I mean, that's what they did. They poured olive oil over and let it dribble from the hair through the beard. And when Jesus talks about when you go around fasting, don't have long faces. People wanted, some of the hypocrites wanted people to know they were fasting, and so they'd leave the olive oil off their face so that the skin was dry that day. And that.
So when Jesus came, he knew he wasn't going to be the Messiah on earth at that time.
Jesus was not, he was not to be, by that particular point in time, see, in the Old Testament, Messiah is so closely related to an earthly political king because it simply means the anointed one and the Lord's anointed, and Saul was the first one that was called Messiah. David the second one, Solomon the third, etc. Every king, when they were anointed with oil at their coronation, they were then claimed to be Messiah. But because of Isaiah 9, Prince of Peace and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and he'll judge with righteousness, and upon the throne of David to sit and rule and reign forevermore. This, throne of David. Earthly political ruler. Son of man, most of the time in the Old Testament simply means a person, a human being. But there's some apocalyptic passages where it speaks of a heavenly figure. And in the intertestamental period between the Old Testament, the end of the Old Testament's writing, and the beginning of the writing of the New Testament, some of those writings in there and some of the teachings start talking about, even in the Testament of the 12 patriarchs, there'll be two messiahs. There will be one that will come from a royal line and set up an earthly kingdom. And once that has been set up properly and he's reigned for a while appropriately, then Son of Man, who is a heavenly figure, would come, would verify that he is a proper earthly ruler, but then he would set up the heavenly kingdom of God that would begin on earth and continue afterwards. So they were initially two separate individuals. Jesus is the only one that they're one and the same. And when Jesus speaks of Son of Man, he's on earth in earthly form as a human being, but he is the heavenly Son of Man, part of the Godhead who has come on earth. So he brings the two together. They don't understand that. If he had chosen to stay, that would have created a whole other issue because they would have continued to have seen him as the earthly one, and they would have been looking for, off in the future, this Son of Man, this spiritual one to come. But Jesus himself says that he needed to go back to be with the Father, and in order to send the Counselor or the Guide that would be present throughout the world to guide you, the Paraclete, Parakletos, the Comforter, the Guide, the Counselor, etc. He said, and he says in the Gospel of John, chapter 16 and 17, in his high priestly prayer that night, he says, I'm going back to the Father. And it's for your good that I'm going back to the Father. I need to go back to the Father in order for this other to happen. If I don't go back to the Father, it can't happen. And so you won't have that guide and that comforter. So this was part of the plan for our redemption and our continued growth. Had he stayed, that wouldn't have happened as it was supposed to.
So Cyrus, he was the Messiah. So that was just a man.
Yes. Yes. He was being called that just like David was Messiah and Solomon was Messiah. He was God's earthly representative. He was ruling and reigning on behalf of God.
Well, any man could probably come into the world today and say, I am the Messiah.
Some do. The Wacko in Waco, also known as David Koresh, said he was. Sun Myung Moon said he was. Of course, we see where that got them. And so Jesus here is saying, you know, he is giving in this, he is using that earthly physical, and he says, you're still physically free, but what's more important, I'm bringing this spiritual dimension to your freedom that you have, that you haven't had with the blessing and the giving of himself here in, at this Last Supper. Now, by this time, they're late in the evening, late in the meal, in fact, close to midnight. When they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And as we've said numerous times before, the hymn would have been one of the Psalms from about 113 to 118. Notice they stopped before you get to 119. It has 175 verses. That'd be like a Billy Graham crusade. Now, so they didn't want, but they would sing this song together as a concluding. This is their way of saying it's over, it's done, let's go. And Jesus said to them, you'll all fall away. It's written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. That's in Zechariah chapter 13, by the way. So once again, he's quoting from the prophets. Just like with Isaiah earlier, it's written. So here, Zechariah, you know, the prophet said this, you'll fall away. Peter, he says, but after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. So he's telling them, you know, I'm going to die. You're all going to run away. I'm going to die. But then I'm going to be raised up, and I'll see you in Galilee, which is where they had been before, and that's where he called most of them from, was Galilee. They lose sight of that in all the stuff that happens. In fact, in the gospel, at the end, after the resurrection, the women are told, go and tell the disciples and Peter, this is Gospel of Mark, and Peter, but I'm going to Galilee. There I'll see them. And so he's giving them instructions. He's saying, you know, this is going to be horrendous. You're going to fall away. But there's light on the other side. There's light at the end of the tunnel. It's not a train. It's good news. But Peter, Mr. Foot and Mouth Disease, opens his mouth, moves one foot from one side to the other, and says, even though they all fall away, I won't. Jesus said, oh, this very night before the cock crows twice, you'll deny me three times. By the way, the cock crowing twice, the rooster crowed at the beginning, the first hint of light, and crowed again when it got full light. And so he says, before that happens, in that short span of time, you're going to deny me three times. But he vehemently said, he had a harsh tone if he didn't scream it at him. He had a harsh tone if he didn't scream at him. And he says, if I must die with you, I will not deny you. And so everybody said, well, we're with him. We'll do the same. We'll do the same. We'll die. And of course, we know how that turned out, too. The little servant girl says, oh, you're one of his. And oh, no. And so they go to a place which was called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. Gethsemane was an olive grove not far distance away. And so they go there. In fact, the olive trees, I haven't been there, but I've been told by colleagues who have made the trip, there are olive trees in Gethsemane that are still producing olives that go way back to the first century. They're still alive. And he says, sit here while I pray, and you know what happens. They all fall asleep. Well, it's late in the day. They've had a big day. They've drunk all this wine. They've eaten all this food. They've got a full belly. We don't have deacons meetings on the Sunday when we have Super Bowl because all that food, we did it 1 year, and everybody was doing this number. And then he takes the big three with him, Peter, James, and John, and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. So Jesus, he's gone through all of this with them, and now when he gets alone with the big three, Peter, James, and John, he finally shows just what a strain this is on him. And he says, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. Word also means keep awake. So he tells me, stay here and keep awake. Watch. He goes a short distance away. Jesus is hoping that somehow they can help him. They'll pray and they can help him with this decision. He doesn't go way far away. He wants them to keep awake and watch him and pay attention to what's going on with him. Going a little farther, he fell on the ground and prayed, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, which means daddy in Aramaic, Father, all things are possible to you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. So he agonizes and he prays, if there's any other way, I really don't want to die. He faces the temptation, am I going to do what you really want or not? And after a while, he gets up and he comes back. He knows they're asleep before they even get there because Peter's snoring. No, he comes back and says to Peter, Simon, you're asleep. Could you not keep awake 1 hour? Which tells us he's already been in agony for close to an hour from the time they got there. He's been in agony for almost an hour, praying, pouring his soul out to God. You know, we see it and we put it in the movies. It lasts just a few minutes. But this is a real struggle that Jesus is having here. Don't know.
Because he knows that's what he's set for.
Well, he knows that that's what needs to come. But at the same time, remember, he has chosen. God has chosen in Jesus to limit, because Jesus even says, well, I don't know when the end's going to be, only the Father does. In some areas, to limit his knowledge and his experience to that which we have, so that we can look to him and say, well, you know, he's been there.
Yeah.
Been there, done that, and we can follow his. Yeah. We can follow his example instead of if he wasn't tempted to give up, then he doesn't have a clue what it is. Not really. I mean, he's 33, 34 years old, and he knows that if he dies, he knows how the Romans are going to do it. And it's not the average time on a cross, crucifixion victim under the Romans was 12 to 18 hours of suffocation. Although Josephus talks about after the fall of Jerusalem, coming through 3 days later and found two of his friends that were still alive that had been nailed to, they weren't nailed to crosses, they were nailed to the sides of buildings because they ran out of crosses. 3 days later. Throughout the Gospels, Peter, with his macho and he's, you know, right from the get-go, you know, Peter leaves his, of course, she might have been happy. Peter left his wife and his family to follow. He even says that at one point. We've left our families and homes. But Peter was the one that seemed to take the lead and be the one that was, when everybody else Peter spoke up. And so, you know, Peter is that one who got really close to Jesus and supported him so much that I think that's part of the reason that he chose Simon Peter. James becomes one of the leaders in the church later on. James and John are brothers, sons of Zebedee. John is the one who some people say is the beloved disciple. But James and John are the ones that seem to, next to Peter, they're the ones that are the most vocal.
How did John give himself his title? Because he's no better than the rest of them. I mean,
that's why I asked that question, because before they had argued about who was going to sit at his right hand.
Yeah. Right and left, yeah. They had been the closest.
Yeah.
The three of those have been the closest to Jesus and the most ardent supporters. And when nobody else would speak up, one of those three would, and it was usually Peter, but then others would follow suit as well. That's where some people question whether the Apostle John actually wrote the Gospel of John or not. There might have been someone else who called him the beloved disciple. the beloved disciple, and yet he was a son of thunder, and he was one that wanted to call down fire and brimstone and all this kind of stuff. Well, he asked Jesus, can we? Come on, please, please, please. We don't like these people. Let's do it.
I just think he's got a certain vanity and egotism and or doesn't have the humility that he should.
And in the Gospel of John says that Jesus on the cross and looks out and sees his mother and the disciple whom he loved. Although, interesting, I don't think the evidence was anywhere near conclusive, but read a book about 3 years ago, picked up a book that guy had been on the talk circuit, and I picked it up and read it. And interesting, he claimed that actually he thought that the beloved disciple was Jesus' younger brother, James, who later becomes a follower, wasn't early on, later becomes a follower and a leader in the church outside of Jerusalem. See, I mean, and part of his argument was, who's going to be most beloved, one of his own family or somebody outside the family? But that was his primary argument. He had a few others, but I wasn't convinced by them. But it was an intriguing idea that maybe the beloved disciple was James.
How many blood brothers did you have?
Well, I mean, you got and Joseph. There are at least two or three.
Much younger than he was, or
that depends on whether you take the position of the developing Roman Catholic Church, which says, and later some within Lutheranism, that they were actually older than Jesus from a previous marriage that Joseph had and his wife died. Or if you go with Matthew saying that Joseph knew Mary not, that is in a sexual way, intimate way, until after she had born Jesus, and in both Matthew and Mark, is not this the carpenter, or is not this the son of the carpenter, or not his brothers here with us, James and Joseph, etc., that they were younger brothers.
Yeah.
We don't have a clue as to how much younger.
I thought one aspect was as in brotherly love type brother, not blood brother, almost like a disciple.
How many
sisters do you have? I do why I asked. We was out there one Sunday morning, I was watching a show, and talking about the virgin birth and so forth, said, and this preacher don't know what religion he's from, said that the Bible speaks of being married to firstborn son, and don't say nothing about being firstborn child. So no where he left.
Well, yeah, and there, you know, there are people. Marcus Borg, who was part of the, don't know if he ever became part of the Borg or not, and that's for Star Trek Next Generation fans. But Marcus Borg was part of the Jesus seminar. Mentioned him before, where he was part of that group that was supposed to look at all this stuff and figure out what in the Gospels Jesus actually said and what was put in there by the church and what miracles were. And Borg came out and said, well, basically, nothing in there Jesus really said. The words put in his mouth by the church. And no miraculous things happened in there, that kind of stuff. And Borg is one of those who said it didn't matter to him whether Mary was a virgin or not, because it spoke of our spiritual birth as our spirits being virginal, and her spirit was virginal. It had nothing to do with that. Borg also said it wouldn't bother him at all if they could prove, found a coffin with bones and prove conclusively they were Jesus' bones, because what was important was Jesus was resurrected spiritually. Didn't matter to him whether it was bodily or not. Borg died about a year and a half ago, so I guess he's found out. But one way or another, he's found out. But I know. And once again, that figures back because one of the Gospels does mention his brothers and sisters. Your mother and your brother and your sisters are here. Brothers and sisters are here. But then that goes back in the church, the Roman churches that developed eventually said, oh, well, those were, because they want to protect the perpetual virginity of Mary, those were from a previous marriage. When Mary is found to be with child, as a virgin, they go out and look for an older man who will agree to live in a platonic relationship with her forever and protect her and care for her. And Joseph, who is an older man who has sons and daughters from a previous marriage and his wife had died, agrees to do that. But that was all part of, you know, their understanding is that Mary if she was pure enough and good enough to be the mother of Jesus, could never have any normal sexual marriage relationship, because that would mean she wasn't pure anymore.
No way.
Sorry, but then again, who is it that's doing all this? Who is it that's coming up with these doctrines and everything? Leaders in the church who are not married, who are celibate, and all that kind of stuff. So, as the church developed early on. Well, yeah. But, people take this and run in all kinds of directions. It's like scattergun. And so they go to Gethsemane, and he says, could you not stay awake 1 hour, watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation? The spirit's willing, I know that, but the flesh is weak. Again, he goes away, prayed, saying the same words, comes back and found them sleeping, for their eyes are very heavy. And they didn't know what to say. He comes back a third time. So Jesus three times prays and agonizes. And when he comes back the third time, he says, you're still sleeping and getting your rest. You're going to need it. It's enough. That's enough. Wake up. Get up. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed in the hands of sinners. Rise. Let's be going. My betrayer is at hand. And it's at that point he wakes them up. Judas shows up with temple guards, some priests, some temple guards, and some Roman soldiers. The bigger contingent of soldiers would be the temple guards to arrest Jesus. And it's 5 minutes to seven. So at that point we'll pick up next time. With the arrest, starting in verse 43 of Mark chapter 14. Thank y'all. God bless you. Go in peace.